people can change. Mm. Feelings can go away. Mm. Feelings will go away. This too shall pass.
My old sponsor used to say to me, if you've got a feeling, wait 24 hours. And then if it's still there, then we can do something about it.
There you go. Normally all these things pass. And like, yeah, it's exactly like that. You look at the person I was, the way I was behaving, the things I was doing on a daily basis for a long time. It wasn't a couple of weeks, years. Now you look at the way I live my life now. Fundamental changes by putting in a bit of action. And the word for me that is key is consistency. Sticking to it. My life was chaotic. Today I've got structure. You know, it's like, oh, leopard doesn't change his spots. It does. I'm not that same leopard. I'm a different person. And anyone who comes in contact with me will tell you. They call me Chrissy 2.0.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholford. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, we welcome Max and Chris, hosts of the Addicted to Recovery podcast. This podcast blends honesty, humor, and heart, diving into real life stories of growth, resilience, and redemption. Christopher White is a 37-year-old podcaster who's been clean for 5 years through Narcotics Anonymous. Chris brings a grounded, no-nonsense perspective to everything he does. Max Thomas is living proof that addiction doesn't discriminate. Privately educated and raised in a loving and supportive family with no history of trauma, Max still found himself caught in a cycle of addiction. Today, Max is over 6 years clean. We talk about the hard truth in admitting self-centeredness, pulling a manipulative ace card, and facts about happiness versus pleasure. Chris and Max, welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thanks.
Appreciate you being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Can you tell me your sobriety? How long have you been around?
I'll be 7 years in March. So yeah, it's just completely transformed my life, Paul, to be fair. Best thing I've ever done. I came kicking and screaming into recovery.
Who was dragging you?
My wife left me, basically. And she had enough after many, many, many times me letting her down, repeating the same behaviours again and again, saying I'm never going to do it again. And I just thought I was a party boy. I was a binge user, so I was never a daily user. So I could go 2 weeks without having a drink. And then that Friday would come round, I'd pop out for it was the same old story of me. I'd pop out for a couple of drinks, and it could be 1 day, 2 days, phone off, two kids at home. Didn't care. Eventually, once I'm either too tired or my money's run out or I felt that bad internally, the phone would go back on and I'd plead to be let back in the house. And yeah, that can only last for so long. The consequences just grew so strong and so much. And I was just letting so many people down, not only my wife and kids, but it was, she said, thanks, but no thanks. And she said, she shut the door and said, no, you need to go and get yourself sorted out. And that's when my journey started, really.
Chris.
A little bit different.
Mm.
Going to be 5 years. I think when this podcast comes out, I'll be 5 years, God willing.
Amazing.
We use differently. I was daily, cocaine, all day, every day, and everything that goes along with that lifestyle. So I was working on sites and just every 20 minutes I did a pinch, simple as that. And when you're in a physical job, that starts taking its toll. Physically, mentally, I was like 10 stone. I weren't eating because I was just constantly
And you're a big guy. How tall are you?
6'4".
Mm. 10 stone.
I think at my lightest, I was at 10 and a half stone.
Wow.
Super skinny, aren't you?
Yeah, I've got about 4 more stone on me now.
Yeah.
My first addiction was food. So I always struggled with my weight. So twisted thinking, with like 4 or 5 years of daily cocaine use behind me, I'm like, look at that.
Thought
I looked good. And didn't look good. I was dead, dying spiritually, mentally, physically, dying. And very similar to Max's situation with the family. Mm. I had a beautiful missus, beautiful son, and it wasn't enough, mate. It wasn't enough. She kicked me out one more time because I always used to get kicked out. Mm. Went to my parents' house because they always used to let me in, and they didn't let me in. Shut the door. I was like, I can't do it anymore. They figured out they'd been enabling me all these years.
Yeah.
And didn't let me in. And I started taking it seriously from that day. So that was the 5th of November, 2020.
So different stories, obviously.
Mm.
How did you come into recovery? Did you go into the rooms? Did someone...
Straight into the rooms. I knew I had an issue with drink and drugs, and it wasn't quite right. And it had been suggested to me to go to meetings before my last use up and last rock bottom. Didn't take it seriously. I didn't think I was an addict. I just thought, I'm a bit of a party boy, like going out, etc.
Is that because all your friends around you was using the same?
Yeah, but looking back now, I definitely used differently. I was always to oblivion. I never ever would sit down on the sofa with my wife with a glass of rosé. Didn't interest me. It didn't interest me to drink socially. I was either 100 miles an hour or not at all. So when I came into recovery, I thought I just had a drink and drug problem. And what I've learned today is I've got a life problem, and drink and drugs was just one of the symptoms of the disease of addiction. It was one of my coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
So this
is what I've always said about the way Max used. You still had the house. You still had money in the bank.
Mm.
He didn't have them glaringly obvious things like my life was burned to the ground. It was so obvious I needed help.
Mm.
And I always admire guys like Max that can come in and dedicate their life to this stuff, because it's a huge commitment when you've still got external things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
That from the outside looking in, you've got your shit together.
Mm.
When really deep down inside, you know you didn't. And the fact that you and people like you, because I've seen a few cases of it, that can come in, dedicate themselves to this stuff, I think it's harder to do than a guy like myself that was just fucking ruined.
Do you not think that inside, if you feel destroyed...
That's what I was going to say.
100%. That's what it all comes down to.
I looked okay. If you saw me walk into a meeting, or if you bumped into me on the street right at the end of my using, you would have probably thought, he's doing all right. He's still got... Mm. Couple of cars on the drive, house, kids.
Mm.
When I turned up to that first meeting, I suppose I was so broken internally, Paul. Mm. I just didn't know what had happened. I remember my last use up, and I went missing for however long, and there was a search party looking for me. And I remember getting dragged home, and I went around my brother's house, and my dad was around there, and both my brothers were around there. And I remember sitting and just bawling my eyes out. Anyway, I went to the toilet to sort myself out. And I remember looking in the mirror and thinking, how the fuck have you ended up here? Because on the outside, I had the business and beautiful family, and I was just rotting internally. And I look back now, like, I was ready to change. I really was ready to change, because I couldn't take acting like that anymore. I'm so grateful now, looking back 7 years in, that my wife did. She said, enough's enough. You need to go and sort your stuff out, because I wouldn't be sitting here today, I don't think.
I think it's really important to say, because I can still do it. If someone says, oh, I saw a drug addict today, I think I have an image in my head of someone, you know, on the floor, white, disheveled, same as an alcoholic. And you forget that it doesn't discriminate.
Mm.
It doesn't matter how much intelligence you have, how much money you have, where you're from, or anything like that. And I think it's really important to share stuff like that. How do you work out the difference between using, because I was more of a binger than a daily user. How do you like talk to each other about that? Like, what's the differences?
Well, basically, what we've come to learn is it doesn't really matter how you used. It doesn't really matter what your situation was. Like you mentioned, people from all different kinds of backgrounds. Like, we get people coming to meetings, and I'm sure you do yourself, like council estate, broken home, parents are addicts. And it's sort of like, oh yeah, well, obviously it sort of makes sense that you're an addict. And then you get like privately educated, family of millionaires, all the opportunities in the world, and they're sitting next to each other in a meeting. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter. The way we relate is how we felt internally. And it, that's what it all comes down to for me, is the feelings. I believe I was born with this. Mm-hmm. Yes, some stuff happened. Went through some traumatic stuff when I was a kid. No more than anyone else. Everyone goes through trauma. For me, I was constantly looking for something external to change the way I felt inside. And it's as simple as that.
How did you feel inside, though, that you want to change it? Because we're used to talking like language like
yeah,
this.
Of course, yeah, yeah. But for the guys at home, I'll tell you how I felt. Max describes this perfectly. It's like I was allergic to myself. It was like all these things I was doing was just like anti-me medication. Give me something. Like when I was a kid, way before substances, even before the food, which was the first one that really had consequences, I would like collect things. Do you remember like every trend or craze? Oh, I was just all over it. Football stickers, pogs, yo-yos.
What's a pog?
Pogs was like these little round things, and it was like you could collect them and you played like a little game of them. No one knew how to play the game. I was just like, you know, like got need.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That need was that dopamine I was looking for. Mm. And I just got so carried away. And what it comes down to me is fear and obsession. I can obsess over anything. And if I'm not on my program now, I can still get wrapped up in that obsession, and I can still cause myself problems.
Mm. If you're not obsessed about something, for example, before you come into recovery, what are you? Like, what's the feelings that you have as normally that makes you divert?
I've always felt uncomfortable. I've always felt inferior. But then at the same time, I can feel superior in the very same instance, like better than and less than in the same breath. Just maladjusted to life. I would look at people just getting on with their day and just be baffled about how they're doing it. I've got an example, and I've mentioned this a lot, and it was sort of glaringly obvious to me when I was maybe still awake from the night before. I'm like twitching at the curtains, and it's Saturday morning, and people are going about their day, and there's like a family walking a dog and a guy over there washing his car. And I'm like, how?
Mm.
How do you do that? But, and not just that, the guy's got a smile on his face. How do you enjoy doing that? I'm like completely isolated from society, using these substances that are clearly killing me. And my best thinking, I'll do that again next week. I'll do that again tomorrow. When all I really want is to be that guy walking the dog with his family on a Saturday morning. Till I come into recovery, I didn't think that was available to me. And it's my whole life. Situation, opportunity, like I had a big job for this money broking firm in the city, and I'm like, all I had to do was just toe the line, six figure salary, come in soon. 2 weeks, fucked it up.
Mm.
It's like all these things that are like, nearly get it right, and then just like, no, do that. It's like self-sabotage on like an epic level with everything that I come in contact with. And I didn't know why. It was so confusing, Paul.
I think addiction's very, very clever. And it's hard to explain to people that it's like your brain gets hijacked. And usually people I've met anywhere in the rooms are really smart, intelligent, quite cunning and whatnot. But you can set something up and then this program kind of takes over to ruin it, which gives you another excuse just to go out and carry on.
Exactly what it is, victim mentality.
It's an illness of the mind, that's how I sum it up. When I'm talking to newcomers who are baffled by how they're feeling, and it's normally after they put the drink and drugs down. So I've always felt this way. I've always been very self-centered, selfish person. I've always been very oversensitive to my feelings and emotions, and I've always been very uncomfortable in my own skin. And that's today as well. Today, I've been shown this program of how to combat each one of those different areas. But I'm not surprised I used like I did. And today, what I've learned is coming into recovery, like, how do I be less self-centered? I be selfless, help others. So I've got five sponsees that I really try and give my time to. And by practicing that selflessness, that then drips into my own family, because I have to really practice to be less selfish. And that's quite hard to say, but that's where I am.
When you say self-centered, right, that always used to confuse me. So for those who don't know what it means, can you maybe describe like a thought process. So
like I can, yeah. Like I'm the center of the, have you seen The Truman Show with
yeah,
Jim Carrey?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it's a film about this guy is stuck in this world and he's the main character in this world.
Yeah.
I genuinely used to think, and I've done some work on myself now, so it's okay for me to admit this, that I was in this, it was the Max Show and people, there was cameras hidden in bushes and trees and I was the center of the universe. That's how my brain used to think. Mm. So for me, that is self-centeredness. I am the most important person on this planet. And that's quite, that can be so suffocating to feel like that.
It must be really, really draining.
It's painful. Yeah. It's so draining. And I'm definitely better at it. But some days I can wake up after having a beautiful weekend with my family and kids. And this is why we say it's a Just for Today program. I can wake up on a Monday morning and feel like an alien in my own house. I can walk into my office and not feel part of. It still consumes me that I am this main character in my own TV show. It really does. Mm. And that's why I have to plug into this program on a daily basis to try and be less selfish. And then this program makes me feel less uncomfortable in my own skin. I'm less oversensitive. That's my battle. I've still got that same illness, but today I've got the different solution. That's how I can explain addiction.
Why do you feel you was born with it?
I'll tell you why. Because the substance doesn't matter. When I was a kid, like I said, basically, I've been educated on this stuff since coming into recovery. I've become a student of addiction.
Hmm.
All the different fellowships, I've read all the literature, and I identify with all of it. But when I think back to my past when I was a child, before I'd ever picked up a substance, I still identify all the way back as far as I can remember.
Mm.
Like Max mentioned, oversensitivity, manipulating. Like I can remember manipulating my mum to get what I wanted. I'm still at nursery.
Mm.
And I know that if I scream the place down, I'm going to get a cuddle or I'm going to get that chocolate bar or I'm going to get whatever it is.
Mm.
It's the same behaviors that I do, maybe not now, but towards the end of my active addiction. Like I suffered some sexual abuse. It was an isolated incident. And this is how I know that I can manipulate and I can sort of curate situations to get what I want and play the victim, right? I kept it like ace up my sleeve to the very end of my addiction. I never told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I told a counselor once. Unfortunately, she passed away. So it was like the secret died with her and I just had this one thing. And anyway, right towards the end of my using, I'd exhausted every other option I had and my missus put it on me once again, rightly so, because I was acting like an idiot. And I was like, because I'm like this, this happened to me when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. The ace card.
Saved it.
Yeah.
Saved it up. She starts crying. I start crying. I get another 3 months out of it.
Yeah.
It's like I desensitize myself from them things to get what I want. And that behavior has just repeated and repeated and repeated throughout my life until I came into recovery and I started becoming accountable. And I think that's the key word.
Mm.
Trauma is trauma. Trauma happens to everyone. Situations I put myself in, situations I put my family and friends in, behaviors I did, just like, Not nice stuff. And the one goal was change the way I feel. I need to feel good right now at all times.
It's incredible to hear someone has done enough work to understand that you've used it as an ace card.
Mm. Unbelievable self-awareness. But like it says in the literature, self-knowledge availed us nothing.
Yeah.
It takes action. Mm. And like Max mentioned about it being a Just for Today program, I can't stay clean on yesterday's recovery. I have to do this every day. Because my disease, my addiction, whatever you want to call it, hasn't gone away. If anything, it's getting stronger. I have to work this program. And we keep saying the program. We're talking about the 12-step program, yeah. Right? So anyone that's not familiar with it, it's like I have to wake up in the morning. Sometimes I forget who I am and what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll start my day like a normal person. And then I start screaming and shouting at people in the car. And everyone's a prick for like pulling out in front. And I'm like, oh, hang on. I didn't do what I was supposed to do this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Other days I'll wake up, I pray, I meditate, I send out a few messages. I connect to other addicts. I talk to my sponsees. I talk to my sponsor. Shock, the day goes smoothly because mm-hmm. I know who I am and I know what I've got to do. Sometimes I forget. And it all comes down to my will
mm-hmm.
versus
God's will.
God's will. And I'm not a religious person. I'm not. When I say God, there's loads of different ways. We like to say group of druggies, group of drunks.
Good orderly direction.
Good orderly direction.
Next right thing.
So just something outside of yourself.
A power you greater than me. And this is what me and Max always revert to is we use the rooms, the fellowship as a power greater than us. Because it's like one, two addicts are more powerful than one. So me and Max, he rings me all the time. Right, he's better.
Is that annoying or is that
good? No, I love it. He's better at it than I am, right? Because I'll still internalize this stuff and think I know best sometimes. Yeah. I'll get a call from Max. I've got this problem and I can see it better than he can see it. Yeah. Just like he can see my shit better than I can see it. We talk it over. That's a power greater than him. It's a power greater than me because two of us are together.
But I only know that because my step work says that when I'm in charge, it all goes tits up normally. I say to Chris a lot of the time, and my sponsees really, how do you explain this like higher power and why is God's will better than Max's will? For me, if you could bottle, say 15 people in a meeting and you could walk around with those 15 people at all times and every time you had a thought come up, you run it past those 15 people. My understanding of recovery is that those 15 people together would come up with the right decision. Any situation in life, any decision that you need to make, if you had those 15 people in the room to run it past, you're going to come to the right decision. Instead of me trying to run the show and normally coming to the wrong decision when I'm reacting to a situation at home, a work colleague talked to me in the wrong way, I need to deal with a situation which I'm not comfortable with. I have to run. I've been programmed now, Paul, to run those decisions normally past Chris or my sponsor or someone else. And it's so far, it's worked for me. I don't do that all the time. Hmm. And because we're human at the end of the day and I react to situations quite quickly and instead of responding to a situation and I make mistakes, especially at home. But it's, yeah, I've definitely improved in that.
Why does this matter? In recovery, why does it matter if you shout and scream at people, if you have a bad day or you've got grumps? What's that got to do in recovery?
For me, when I get angry, I'm acting out on a defect. I've got defects of character, some worse than others, but they cause problems in my life, avoidable problems. And rage and anger is just a reaction to fear for me. And it all comes down to two things, right? Fear of not getting what I want, and fear of losing what I've already got. And that doesn't have to necessarily be a material thing. It could be your perception of me.
Mm.
So the ones I remember mostly from active addiction is the feeling of embarrassment. If I felt like I'd been like mugged off.
Cringy one, yeah.
I could not forgive and I could not forget. Mm. Something would have happened to me when I was like 15 years old. And I'm at work, 25 years old, and it would just pop into my head.
Mm.
And I cannot get it out of my head. And I've rung the bloke up, screamed at him down the phone. I'm meeting him later. We're going to have a fight. I'm going to do all these kung fu moves in this fantasy version of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I've lost an hour of my life resenting this thing that happened. That person probably doesn't even know it happened. Mm. It's all perception, right? So that fear of losing what I've got could be pride-based. I'm supposed to be a man and that macho stuff, this is all a load of bullshit. And I'll get wrapped up in that stuff. Fear of losing what I've already got could be, once again, you think of me a certain way, so I can't act or behave a certain way because otherwise that opinion will change. Or it could be down to something as simple as I've got a nice house that my family live in and I'm scared that I'm going to lose it. So I have to take action in order to keep it. And some of this stuff is really destructive and others is really positive. If I'm running on defects, I'm not running on spiritual principles. And like Max has already mentioned about the self-centered, being selfless, there is an opposite spiritual principle to every defect of character.
Mm.
So if I'm being greedy, if I'm generous, I'm not being greedy anymore. If I'm being self-centered, I can do selfless service and it counteracts that. And that's basically how I try and live my life. But me, other than by myself, like Max has already mentioned, if I'm running the show, I will burn my life to the ground. I've got so much evidence that proves that. I can't do it on my own. So if I'm running on the wheel of a higher power, or like Max has mentioned, it's a great way of putting it. Would I act this way if my sponsor was standing next to me?
Mm.
Probably not. Okay, then you shouldn't do it. And if I do it, then I'm acting on self-will and my will gets me in trouble. I can take it even further. If my sponsor, my missus, my mum, my children, someone I look up to, Max, is standing there in the room, am I going to act that way? No, I'm not. Okay, well, don't do it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
That's why it's like power greater than me doesn't have to be some spiritual entity. No. It could be people in our life, real people.
What do you guys think is important about why you have to have live a spiritual life? Because we live in a materialistic world, don't we? So it's about the cars on the drive or getting a good job and getting numbers in for a podcast or whatever. Why is it important to have a spiritual life?
Because fundamentally, Paul, so I've sold businesses in the past. I've got lovely, shiny things. I mean, I've been on lovely holidays and experienced nice things, but my spirit is topped up more than any of those things put together when I see a newcomer pick up his 30-day keyring. Like, helping others gives me more spiritual top up than anything that I've experienced financially or in
business.
What's
a spiritual top up?
Yeah, so a spiritual top up for me, most of it comes from helping other people. I've had dozens of sponsees. I think I've got 5 all the way through to work because the numbers are not good. The odds are not good of people coming in and sticking to this stuff and taking it all the way. And I can honestly say the biggest buzz I've ever had in my life. Like, one of my sponsees is a year clean today and he was struggling. You put me onto him. He's been on our pod. He was struggling, man, really struggling. And he got a year clean. He's got his missus in his life. He's just been given custody of his granddaughter because, not going to go into that situation, but this guy is now like a responsible person and he was done 1 year ago. That buzz I get from giving freely of my time, I'm busy, really busy, and I've got loads of stuff going on. I'm spinning plates all day long and I will take time out of my life to help this guy because someone took time out of their life to help me. And the buzz I get from helping that guy gives me that spiritual top up.
It's like a sense of pride. Do you know when when I was a kid and you get man of the match in football, you that proud
feeling.
Weren't
they good, but.
No, but do you know what I mean? That sense of, I feel it when I watch my kids at sports, they're like that proud, that's how I feel. That's how I can, someone said, describe filling up your spiritual tank. For me, it's that feeling of just, giving selfless acts of kindness, I suppose.
Well, I guess it's the opposite to feeling self-obsessed and what someone's talking about, what you're looking at. So you feel something inside that's full.
And like you were mentioning earlier on about why is it so important to live that spiritual life? We live in this financial, materialistic world. It's a load of bollocks. It doesn't matter. Like Max just said, I'll have a really nice watch on, driving a really nice car, really fit bird. And I'll feel empty inside. I could be, when I first come out of rehab, I was living in a dry house in Southend. This gaff was like Kazi, right? I was on benefits. I was getting universal credit. I had one pair of trainers and I felt so whole. And just I got goosebumps thinking about it now. It was I'd gone from darkness to light.
What, just comfortable in your own skin?
Comfortable in my own skin. I could start looking people in the eye. I was helping. People were looking at me like, fuck it, what has happened to you? Just this change in me, right?
Well, the bullshit had gone, right?
Stripped away, gone. So you talk about spiritual life versus materialistic. I'll go on Instagram, I'll get sucked into it. I'm a human being.
Oh yeah.
There's a reason this stuff is so popular is because for a split second, you're like, wow, how good is that? Go and buy a Ferrari. That feeling of oh my God, I'm the bollocks, I've got a Ferrari. It doesn't last.
Don't for me, no.
Have you ever seen Mad Men?
Yes.
So you know the advertising industry when it picked right up in the 60s and then now that's basically taken over society, right? It's not real. It's been created, right? And I heard this guy talk about it and it's stuck with me. The difference between pleasure and happiness. And you mentioned before we got going about serotonin and dopamine, right? Serotonin is happiness. Dopamine is pleasure. Shiny things, cars, watches, that's dopamine. This is not serotonin because you can't sell serotonin. You can sell dopamine. and people can make money from it.
Mm.
So that's what's driven this whole society, is the fact that you think you're buying happiness, but you're not. You're buying pleasure. Serotonin is long-lived. Dopamine is short-lived.
Mm.
Once it runs out, you need to buy something else. Or in my case, sniff a line of pure dopamine, which is cocaine.
Mm.
And I got wrapped up in it, mate. Bottles in the club, spending all my money on fucking nonsense.
Yeah.
And it didn't work, mate. I wasn't happy.
Most people are just brought up on the advertising, what you said. Mm. And something has to happen for you to realize that it's futile.
Mm.
Yeah.
And great, it's so nice futile. To hear. Paul, yeah. With me, I'll go back to that. My business. I built a business up over 15 years, decent sized business, really proud of it. And the day came where I sold this business and it was like it had never happened. My wife looked at me like I was a crazy man because it just passed me by. I bought classic cars, obsessed about it for 2 years, like looking at loads of, like went up north looking at it with my dad a few times, driven it once since I've had it. Because it's just, once I've got that, it's done. It's not, like Chris saying, that pleasure and happiness, it didn't, it's the chase. It's, for me, I got more of a buzz picking up cocaine than I did taking it.
Yeah.
That is the chase.
People don't talk about that, do they?
No, it's the chase, the excitement, it being in your pocket, after the first line, it's all downhill from there.
Mm.
It's a funny one. And I have to watch that today. Decisions that I make, especially around buying stuff, what are my intentions?
I remember standing next to you the day the money came through from you selling your business.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, wow.
Mm.
And it was like, so you're going to that meeting later? Just like, gone. Yeah. Next thing. What's next?
Mm.
And I think we are, especially addicts, it's not about what's happening right now. It's what we're going to do next.
Mm.
It's the anticipation. Like you said, picking up the gear was sort of the buzz.
Yeah.
I used to smoke a lot of weed. When I was a kid, I smoked a lot of weed for a lot of years. And I liked the like ritual of it, the getting it, the smell of it before it'd been smoked, the rolling of the joint, like having all my bits just how I want them. I preferred that to the feeling of being stoned.
Mm.
But I would still get stoned every day.
Right.
Because you can't have the ritual without the other bit. And it was just another one of them things, like I mentioned earlier about me trying to, I love the expression getting out of my head because my head was loud and it wasn't a comfortable place to be. So if I could do something that got me out of my head, I would do it. And weed was a cost-effective, long-lasting way of getting out of my head. The reason I stopped doing so much weed is because it was obvious that I was taking it. The reason I landed on cocaine is I could do cocaine and you wouldn't necessarily know I was doing it because there was no smell. I could get it out of my pocket and put it away quickly. I didn't really drink because I'd be slurry and it'd be obvious that I'd been drinking. That's why I landed on that drug. It's like I was very secretive about the whole operation I had going on. It wasn't like a social thing. It was me isolated on my own, nipping in and out of situations. And people would, if I'd done half an hour in front of you and I'd been doing cocaine all day, I could get in and out of that situation. You would never know I was on it. Mm. Sometimes I'd get it wrong. But most of the time, you would never know. And we mentioned this. All I was doing was using to get to zero. Oh, there was no buzz. I was using to get to zero. I was waking up in the morning so down, so low. I would use just to get to that baseline. I never went up. And I would just try and hover along that line.
Sad, really, isn't it?
So
it's
sad.
It's the same as smoking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you just get back to feeling relaxed a bit.
It's funny, I was coming to see you today. A little bit nervous, apprehensive. Well, I'm 16 days off the cigarettes today.
What? Oh, yeah.
And
well done.
I said to Chris, I am consumed or wanting a cigarette because cigarettes really, Paul, just changed the way I feel for that little split second. I never used to really enjoy cigarettes. I would smoke them so quick just to get that little buzz.
Mm.
And it's funny, even today coming up here, I want something to change the way I feel. I'm looking for something to fix my internal anxiety.
How do you describe to people the feeling that I had when I first come in and I just felt naked and raw and really fucking vulnerable. But that all turned into an asset as I went through my recovery. Where are you guys at now with day-to-day stuff.
So when I first came into recovery, Max will back me up on this, I came in with so much bravado.
Did you?
So I didn't get it first time. I went to my first meeting when I was 27 and I got clean when I was 32. So I was in and out, in and out, in and out, a few different fellowships. I came to NA, the fellowship that I stuck with.
But what were you thinking when you was coming in there? Where was you going if you...
Oh, man, I was fucking...
Bit of lip service.
I was just lost, mate. Absolutely lost. I'll tell you who it was. First time I was going is because I was trying to get people off my back. Yeah. Right. I knew I had a problem. I thought I had a drug problem. Like Max has mentioned, I had a me problem, but I didn't know that at the time. And I came in with this huge bravado that I'm all right. And I stuck around for about 100 days. And then I relapsed. And it took me 2 years to get back. And that 2 years of my life was just dark, sad.
Was that because isolated. You'd actually heard a solution?
So I think there was a couple of reasons why that was so dark is because I'd heard the solution. I had a head full of the 12-step program and a belly full of booze and drugs. Mm. I'd also told everyone in my life
that I was an addict.
So, and I'm like, don't ever let me do that again.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
So what happened was really my small. World just went boom.
Super small.
So I'm going to meetings, picking up fake clean time key rings, pretending to everybody that I'm not using whilst daily using.
Super sneaky. That must have been really painful.
Exhausting. Yeah. Mate, people say to me, you mentioned about when you first come in and you feel vulnerable. It was a relief, mate.
Mm.
It was a relief. People say, oh, that must be hard. Coming into recovery and staying clean. And I'm like, mate, walk in the park compared to daily cocaine.
It's so good to hear.
Walk in the park, mate. Doesn't even compare. The hardest thing I've ever done is that last 2 years of my using. Stealing, lying, cheating, manipulating, working. Because I stole and my parents are the ones who copped it. I think I'm a bit of a bad man, like in my head. I'm not. I used to steal from my parents because I knew there was no consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the shame and the guilt and the remorse that's coupled with that fuels that need to use and get out of my head even more. And I'm just stuck on this vicious cycle. Like my mum and dad would let me in their house after my missus had kicked me out. I'm showing up two bin bags full of clothes back in my childhood bedroom. They're like, oh, poor thing.
Mm.
I know where the safe is. I'm like, thank you for looking after me. Wait until they go out. I'm breaking in the safe and stealing the money so I can go and pick up again, right? And I can sit here and say that now because I've done loads of work around that and I've made amends for that process. And one of the biggest things that's happened to me in my recovery, and funny enough, there was a situation of it today, I'm financially trustworthy today. That safe that I used to steal money out of, when I got clean, I put my mum in charge of my finances and I would get paid. Sometimes I'd get paid cash. And I would give it to my mum. So I'd go around there and give it to her and she'd put it away for me and look after it. And one day I went around there to give it to her and she wasn't in. And she said, the code for the safe is, and gave me the code. I opened the safe and I put money in it and closed it.
Nice, man.
I'm getting a little bit emotional thinking about it.
That must have been a really big day.
Mm. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
Mm.
I used to take the money out of that and now I'm putting it back in.
Mm.
That's the change.
That's powerful.
My parents come to me now for problems. If there's an issue in the family, I get the phone call. That didn't used to happen. One, I wouldn't pick up the phone, but it just didn't. I wasn't that guy. I wasn't that go-to person. Talking about vulnerability, I'm still a big crier in meetings now. I'm very emotional guy, but I just think I feel so blessed that I have got somewhere to go and be vulnerable and not be judged. I sat in a meeting on Monday, 50-year-old guy crying his eyes out about how his brother's really unwell in hospital. And he was just concerned and just having that ability to, like, can you imagine going down the boozer and crying your eyes out to your guy over a pint of Foster's? They'd be like, he's a bit of a buzzkill, isn't he? Mm. It's like, do you know what I mean? But it's
a bit.
It's just not, yeah. It's just, look, I think that it came out about Ricky Hatton, didn't it, today? Like, he took his own life, bless him. Like,
oh, did he? I didn't read that.
Yeah, it's confirmed suicide today.
It's but men in society today, I think suicide in the UK is still the biggest killer of men under the age of 65.
It's been, over the last years off since COVID, it's the highest deaths ever under the age of 40.
And let's have it right. It's not really being spoken about, is it? Go back to vulnerability. I just feel honoured and blessed that I've got a place to go on a Monday and a Wednesday. And if I'm really having a bad day and want to cry for 2-3 minutes, and I can, and people won't judge me. Actually, people will come up to me after the meeting and say, Max, how are you? Do you want to go for a coffee tomorrow? Mm. Like, where else is that available?
I've told a story before. Like, I was splitting up with a girlfriend. I was in LA. We lived in Miami together. And she flew over to see me. And all I had to do was drive down in basically one street down Sunset Boulevard to meet her at a hotel. And it was probably 8-minute drive, something like that. 4 hours later or whatever, I rock up, totally stoned, completely got lost, which is impossible.
One road.
Yeah, literally, yeah. And I'm like, fuck, I'm sure they changed the buildings. I was completely off my head. Got there. All I wanted to say was, I love you, please. Can I have a cuddle? Let's sort this out. And she said to me, you've done it again, haven't you? Mm. And where have you been? And I was like, oh, well, there you go. And that was it. And that was the end of it. Mm. And all I ever wanted to do was say my truth. And I think that vulnerability is misunderstood as a weak thing. Mm. And I think to allow yourself to get emotional, to sit still, and just allow them emotions to come up, pass, and come back down to yourself is a strength.
Well, we call it vulnerability, but really, if you look into it, it's honesty, because you're honestly saying how you're feeling on that day. Mm. A lot of men are dishonest about how they're feeling. You ask a lot of guys, how are you doing today? I'd be, I'm all good. That's the go-to response, isn't it? Yeah. There was even a guy at my meeting the other week, and I said, how are you doing? He said, I'm all good.
I'm
said,
fine.
How are you really doing? And he said, actually, I've got this going on.
Yeah.
It's vulnerability for me is brutal honesty. And that's what I've had drummed into me coming into recovery. Be brutally honest. And that's what I say to my sponsees. I want to know if you're having a good day, a bad day, indifferent day. I want to know, because it's doing, I used on my feelings that I couldn't. That's why I was a binge user. It would build and build and build. And then I describe it as like a rucksack full of resentment and fear. And alcohol and drugs took that away from me. And now being in recovery, I've got that another tool in my armory to just be able to get that stuff off my chest and get on with life.
I think that's really important, because I feel like guys are like sieves. If you just pour stuff in it, it will build up and then something will happen. And the suicide thing is because a lot of people don't want to hurt other people, but they just feel like after constant thoughts and feelings of comparison, like, oh, he's done well in his business, I haven't, or he's got that girlfriend, I haven't, I can't be free to do what I want to do, they just take themselves out.
I just think it's sad, like Ricky, for example, just if he, one phone call could have changed the whole situation, couldn't it?
Well, this is it. I heard, funny enough, it was Jimmy Carr talking about it, and he said it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. People can change. Feelings can go away. Feelings will go away. This too shall pass.
My old sponsor used to say to me, if you've got a feeling, wait 24 hours. And then if it's still there, then we can do something about
there
it.
There you go.
Normally
all
it's
these
gone.
Things pass. And like it's exactly like that. You look at the person I was, the way I was behaving, the things I was doing on a daily basis for a long time. It weren't a couple of weeks, years. Now you look at the way I live my life now. Fundamental changes by putting in a bit of action. And the word for me that is key is consistency. Sticking to it. My life was chaotic. Today I've got structure and I've got routine and I stick to it on a daily basis. That can be applied. It doesn't have to be an addict. If a guy is struggling with his mental health or a girl struggling with their mental health, put in some action, get vulnerable, like you said, get honest, talk about what's going on, come up with a solution to the problem and act on it, stick with it on a daily basis. You can fundamentally change as a human being. You know, it's like, oh, leopard doesn't change his spots. It does. I'm not that same leopard. I'm a different person. And anyone who comes in contact with me will tell you. They call me Chrissy 2.0. The new guy. I was fucked, Paul. Fucked. And I'm not fucked anymore. I still have my moments. We spoke about this materialistic stuff. I'm wearing a really expensive pair of trainers.
I saw.
And I've got a really expensive watch on my wrist, right? I'm not immune to this stuff. It feels good, briefly. The watch, I've got an excuse for. Let's send amends to myself. I sniffed a Rolex in my active addiction and I treated myself when I got a few years clean. But
that's different.
There you go.
That's a positive reward and it's nice to look good.
Mm.
It's the difference is if you're obsessed about your trainers, have you seen my trainers? I've got my trainers, I've got women trainers, I've got this. Or you like, I look smart and these are nice.
Or it's if you've got five thing. Rolexes.
There you go. But then what did I say? Oh no, they're investments.
I was just about to say that. They are.
Collector's items. They're only going up in value. Mm. But this is the thing, right? I had a Rolex, gold Rolex. Same one, but it was gold, right? And I sniffed it. Simple as that. And I was fuming that I sniffed it. If I'd kept hold of that, I would have made a nice bit of money on it. So 3x from the time I had it. And I think I was like three years clean when I got it.
Mm.
And I was like, I had the money and it was sort of like an amends to myself. I got to replace that thing and it felt good to do it. But I follow like 6 or 7 watch accounts on Instagram and I can become obsessed with it because, I don't know, I'm a human being, right?
But that stuff's not going to kill you.
Of course it's not. Unless I start taking out credit cards and loans to go and buy the thing.
That's different.
There you go. So that's like putting in a negative action for a, once again, this that stuff's all temporary.
How do you find social media, Paul?
Love it.
I hate it.
I fucking can't stand it.
Okay.
If I didn't have to be on it, I wouldn't be on any of it.
Did
you see I've got a Nokia in my bag? Okay. That's my phone I use most of the time.
Okay.
And when I post and I don't do emails until I get home.
Do you obsess around it?
No, I think because of a lot of my career was obsessive when I'm in something.
Yeah.
Like a magazine, photo shoot, whatever. And I feel like I'm immune to it now.
Mm.
Like I generally feel like I'm immune to it. What I do find is that if I'm looking at a cars or something online, because I'm a real petrolhead, that I can look up and I'm like, oh my God, I've been on here for 40 minutes.
Mm, yeah.
So I'll lose time.
Yeah.
I won't obsess about it, but I'll just be like, oh, let me just have a look. And I will lose 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's
I can relate to that.
Yeah, that's a thing.
Mate.
Yeah.
Gets me bad.
Doom scrolling.
Mention it in a meeting. One of the readings we was doing, there's a new piece of literature in our fellowship and it's really up to date. And there was a thing in there about phone use.
Mm.
And gets me in trouble, man. Gets me in trouble as a parent. Gets me in trouble as a partner. Gets me in trouble at work. It's another addiction.
Mm.
I say it's another addiction.
Well, it fires off the same path, neural pathways.
So it literally does.
What was you saying about the reels? It's all based off a fruit machine.
Yeah.
Next one. And then you get that one that gives you that hit and you're like, oh, that's the win.
Let's go again.
Let's have another one. And you keep scrolling. It's like a 1 in 10 chance of hitting. And when you hit, that's the win. It's virtually impossible for me to live my life without an iPhone.
Yeah, we get lots of messages, don't we, to reply to on social media.
There you go. People reach out to us. We help people. You know what I mean? We haven't mentioned our podcast. Our addiction podcast is that it's reaching so many people and people are reaching out to us and we write back to them. That's all through the phone. I'm tied to it.
Mm.
So what I have to do now is work my program around that thing, put in boundaries. Don't let it encroach into my life in a negative way. Use it as a tool for a positive gain. And sometimes I fall short.
Mm. So the podcast, how are you getting on with the podcast? So you've done how many, 90?
90 episodes.
90 episodes.
90 weeks in a row. We haven't missed a week.
Not missed a week.
Seriously.
Yeah.
How's it changed from the beginning?
Oh, it's just the best thing I've ever done.
Oh, we love it.
It's so good.
We were giving it a go. I'm on another podcast. Comedian Josh James is an Essex-based comedian. Been friends with him for years. He's sort of up and coming. He's doing really well. He's out on tour now. And he invited me to come on his podcast just to tell my story, because my story is quite interesting. And he sacked the guy that was his co-host, and I started the week after. And I've been doing that ever since. So we were playing golf, me and Max, and we wanted to do something together. We didn't really know what. We wanted to do a venture. And I said, what about an addiction podcast? We started from then. Max was a complete newbie. didn't take him long to pick it up.
No.
This guy is not the guy that was on that first episode. But this is it, right? You believed in yourself. I believed in you. We did it together. We just give it a go. First few episodes was just like talking about sort of basic stuff. And then we found a groove, like what we do. And it's basically guest driven. We get another recovering addict, could be of any type. We've had overeaters, we've had gamblers, we've had alcoholics, crack and heroin addicts, all the way down to like, it could just be someone that's just struggling.
Yeah.
But it's all about addiction. And pretty much everyone has been around a 12-step solution. And that's what we're trying to drive, that narrative. Because this, I'm not saying it's the only thing that does work. It's the only thing that's ever worked.
It helps, Paul, when you're so passionate. I believe today that being an addict is my biggest asset. I truly believe that I've been put on this earth to go down this path, make the mistakes I did, come out the other side and help other people. And we've had numerous people, I'm saying numerous, it's more than that, listen to the podcast without even knowing about a 12-step fellowship, and now are a year clean, 18 months clean, 6 months clean, and they're flying in their life. And we talk about filling up that spiritual tank.
Mm.
That it's amazing. We get guys and women and family members reach out to us daily, and the gratitude that they show to us. And I always go back to them and say, look, we do this because someone else did this for me, Paul. Someone else took me to the side at one of my meetings that I go to when I was really early on, gave me their time. So this is mine and Chris's. We just want to give other people our time. And we found this is a good way of doing it.
Do you know what's lovely to hear?
Mm.
It's so selfless.
Mm.
And I can hear it's genuine as well to give back.
Yeah, we really care about it. Yeah, it's definitely the best thing that I have ever done in my career so far.
Did people just start messaging you out of the blue? Or did you put something out to say, message us if you've got
It's grown
issues?
So much, like round numbers, we get 20,000 listeners a month now. Like we'll be 2 years in February. And we started off with...
That's a lot of ears.
It is a lot of ears. Mm. And it blows me away. It's like 50 different countries. And the reaction has just been amazing. It really, really does.
Most of the communication's through Instagram. So we'll put the episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And then we'll do an Instagram post that goes with it, either a clip or just saying new episode out. So we've got a bit of a following now. We're up to about 17,000 followers on Instagram, right? And we only post addiction content.
Mm.
No brands, no nothing. It's just solution. So people DM us on Instagram, and it's daily, sometimes more, sometimes it's a lot every day, but everyone who's ever messaged us
gets a reply.
Mm. And that's what we're doing it for. Mm. Right? Like we said to you before we started recording, we've had people who had no idea about any sort of 12-step recovery, come into recovery, got themselves a year or more clean, and have then come on the podcast as a guest.
Yeah, one of the ladies.
And the cycle continues.
One of the ladies, she'd never heard about 12-step fellowship before. She's now 18 months clean, and she's just opened a meeting in one of the prisons up north to give back to.
Beautiful, right?
That sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Makes me just so proud of what we're doing.
Yeah. It's saving lives, isn't it? It's incredible.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's saving our lives as well, Chris, isn't it?
Of course, you can only keep what you have by giving it away, right? A big meeting is what, 50 people?
Mm.
A really big meeting is 100 people. You hear about some of these like big ones in town or like these old ones.
The biggest one I've been to was about 150 people in
there
the States.
There you go, right? 150 people, it's a big meeting.
Mm.
We can do 10, 15K on one episode.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot more ears, like you mentioned. It's a lot more people helping. It's a lot more seeds planted. So we're stuck now. Even if we wanted to stop doing it, we can't, right? Because
you definitely shouldn't.
And we're not going to, because it's helping so many people. And I mentioned earlier on about consistency and routine and structure. It's the reason why we don't miss episodes. We put our episodes out early hours of Monday morning. There's addicts, like Max was saying, all over the world. The first thing they do on their way to work Monday morning on their commute is they put our podcast on and listen to it. And it sets them up for that working week.
It's lovely, isn't it?
If someone goes to look for it and it's not there, we feel responsible.
Mm.
So we're going to keep it going.
There was a chap that reached out to me, and obviously not going to name names, but he was in a mental hospital. locked in a, wherever he was, in a institution, and he said that the pod, he started listening to the podcast, and it's what he listens to every week on a Monday morning. Just those sorts of stories, Paul, just like, we can't miss a week. Why would we miss a week?
Podcasts are really important. I'd love to have heard them for me before, because it's like what you do. I have it in the car all the time. I listen to podcasts, I listen to stuff, and it's just constant reaffirming good information, isn't it?
Mm.
Can you give us some tips for people who are probably at their first sober Christmas?
Mm.
How do you do it? What do you do?
So I was a nightmare at Christmas. So I used to be a nightmare at Christmas. Even with kids and a wife, I'd always, like, I'm just popping out for a few beers on Christmas Eve or whatever it is, and just fuck Christmases up left, right and centre. And or I'd get too pissed on Christmas Day and have a row with my dad or whatever it was. I used to just be a nightmare. But sober Christmases, and I'm quite good with this, I've been on stag do's and weddings and all that sort of stuff. And what I try and do, especially around Christmas time, is a real good tip for me is get involved. Either be the guy who's in charge of the games with the kids, or be the serving the food to everyone. Don't isolate yourself away and I'm not drinking and I can't have fun. For me, flip it on its head and be proactive at Christmas. Like I said, be the games master or whatever you want to do. I think the worst thing you can do is to isolate. That's one of my big tips as well. What else you got, Chris?
So obviously early doors, you got to be careful. You got to mitigate certain situations. Like Max just mentioned about going to weddings and stag do's and holidays. I can go into any situation now and anyone can be doing anything. Doesn't faze me. Early doors, I had to mitigate them circumstances. I didn't go to pubs. I didn't go to clubs. I didn't go to these things. Christmas is a drinking culture, right? Mm. Some people who don't drink all year round will drink at Christmas. So you're going to be around it. What I would say is, and I'll never really try and talk about avoidance, but if you've got friends and family that are close to you and they're coming over, maybe try and mitigate it slightly, as in like, ask them if they would maybe refrain. If they won't, you need to have something in place to keep yourself protected. I like to say, if you're going out, have an exit strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you're trying to stay sober, you're not going to be drinking. If you drive. Take your own car.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to leave, leave.
Yeah, don't rely on someone else to take you home.
Never rely on someone else. Also, what I would say is make people aware of your situation. Like Max said about isolating, I know some people try and protect their anonymity for certain reasons. For me, I've always been open with it, because the more people that know, the more people can keep an eye on me. Not that I need people to keep an eye on me anymore, but in the beginning, I did. So, exit strategy, make people aware of your situation. Try not make a taboo out of it.
And we always encourage, like we always go for a walk, Paul, break up the day. Instead of just sitting down and everyone getting pissed up, we always go for a walk at some point during the day, and it gives you that space you need. I mean, I can feel quiet, especially I've got quite a loud family. There's about 25 of us. And sometimes I feel quite pressure cooker situation and dealing with lots of different people, and I'm oversensitive, and like I said before, quite uncomfortable in my own skin. Christmas time can be quite tough. So having that, popping out for a 45-minute walk, even if it's just, if you're with a big family, you might just say, right, with me and my wife and the kids, is going to pop out for half an hour, get some fresh air. Those sorts of things to break up the day, I find quite valuable. It's like a fresh start. I always go for a walk in the morning with my dog, and it's sort of, it makes my day a lot nicer, because it's that time where I can breathe. I'm out in nature. Because Christmas, if you've got a family like mine, which is quite chaotic sometimes, especially on Christmas Day, I need that time for myself.
Guys, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Mate, thanks for having us on. It's been great.
Really appreciate it, mate.
Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us today on This Is Powerful. Just to let you know, we'll be back on Thursday, the 1st of January, with a compilation of some of our favourite clips. This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul's Goldfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Skolfort.